Hey everyone, this is Jeannie. I use she, her pronouns, and you're listening to Sex Talk Happy Hour, a podcast hosted by the New York City Alliance Against Sexual Assault. Three quarters of the year have already passed this by, and I kind of can't believe how quickly it happened. We're already in October. For many of us, it's the official start of autumn, the season of pumpkin spice, the month of Halloween, or if you don't celebrate Halloween, at least the month of Halloween candy. It's also known as Domestic Violence Awareness Month, or DVAM, as we call it in the advocacy community. October is a month where advocates, allies, and survivors come together to raise awareness and education around domestic and intimate partner violence. There are events across the country, and if you're interested in checking one out, I definitely recommend looking at a college campus community or going onto the website of local domestic violence prevention agencies. Domestic and intimate partner violence is a very difficult topic to think about, especially when we consider that, according to the WHO, approximately 1 in 3 women globally will experience some form of it in their lifetime. And by no means is this violence exclusively experienced by those identifying as women. In fact, domestic violence doesn't discriminate at all. People of all genders, sexual orientations, racial and ethnic backgrounds, education levels, etc., etc. Everyone from any background can experience this type of violence, although it is important to note that the majority of those who are victimized do identify as women. As we move into a month meant to raise awareness, we thought it would be important to highlight the experiences of someone who's experienced intimate partner violence. So today, I'm speaking with Jessica Sims. She's an incredible woman with a PhD in philosophy who's agreed to share a little bit about her life and her experience with us today. In addition to Jessica, you'll also be hearing from Lorena Heron, who works for an anti-violence agency called Day One, focusing on relationship violence, about how to support a friend or family member who might be experiencing abuse. As always, we want to provide our self-care heads up, and maybe this episode comes with a little extra warmth. This episode may be difficult to hear at times, and we encourage you all to take care of yourselves as you listen. Okay, without further ado, here's my interview with Jessica. Thank you so much for being with us today. I would love for you to introduce yourself, the pronouns that you use, and what you do slash where you work.
Hi, Jeannie. Thanks so much for having me today. My name is Jessica Sims. My preferred pronouns are she and her. And during the day, I conduct market research for an engineering firm here in New York City. And by night, I am the director of communications for AAUW Empire State New York City branch. So yeah, I'm happy to be here with you today.
So you are super busy. For our listeners who don't know what AAUW is, would you mind giving just a quick synopsis?
Oh, yes, absolutely. AAUW stands for American Association of University Women. And this organization is a national organization, and they support women's education.
Awesome. Well, that's definitely something I can get behind. So speaking of women's education, I know that you and I met at an event for my agency, actually, and we hit it off because you were telling me a little bit about your PhD dissertation and sort of what that was about and how you came about it. To your comfort and ability, you know, could you tell us more about that dissertation and why you chose that topic?
So I recently completed my doctorate in philosophy at Stony Brook University. And the topic of my dissertation research was Stockholm Syndrome in cases of domestic violence. And when I initially started that project, I was very interested in answering the question, why is it the case that sometimes people cling to individuals who are harmful to them? Or how is it the case that people will make decisions that are not beneficial to them? And initially the project was very theoretical. I wanted to talk about whole populations and how populations could be swayed into making decisions that were not good for them. But my committee asked that I really narrow down the topic to something that people could connect with. And the more I thought about the question of individuals siding with those who were harmful to them, the issue of domestic violence came to the fore for me. And I justified this narrowing down in my mind because a very close friend of mine was working in the area of domestic violence, and she and I were on the phone a lot talking about her new job that she'd just gotten. And that's kind of how I came to that, unbeknownst to anyone, was the fact that I, about 10 years earlier, had been in a long-term abusive relationship, mentally and physically, and that this was somewhat informing my decision to
choose this as a topic. However, even in my own mind, it wasn't really coming to the fore, which may sound strange, but I wasn't really acknowledging it as an issue for myself at that point. So that's where I started the project. And then over the course of 3 years, I looked to contemporary and ancient philosophical theories of consciousness. I discovered that it's possible to reshape an individual's personal identity through a certain set of behaviors. The language that I use in my dissertation is, instead of saying victim and abuser, I use the term captor and captive in order to demonstrate that it's possible for an individual to captivate another, to make her forget herself and become focused on the needs and desires of another before her own, even to an extreme instance. And what I discovered was that human beings develop their personal identity by engaging others from childhood. And by repeatedly carrying out certain activities, you start to become habituated to the world. You start to relate to the world in habitual ways. And as you do this, as your activities begin to sediment for you, you start to take on a view of the world in terms of the things that you're capable of doing. As we mature, we start to develop a personal worldview, we start to develop a personal identity. However, since these habitual activities aren't simply by nature, but they are cultivated, it's actually possible for them to become corrupted, broken down, and in worst case scenario, rebuilt by another, such that you stop viewing the world in terms of your own personal needs, as I said before, and start to view the world in terms of the needs of another, who, in cases of domestic violence, it's very common for women's identities to be reshaped such that they take the needs of their captor far above their own, to the point of even possibly death. So that's what I was exploring for the last 3 years, and I did delve into the issue of anxiety. I discovered that the main trigger for this conversion of the individual's identity is the triggering of chronic anxiety in the captive, such that she begins to fear her own self, her own moods, and looks for comfort in the person that she's likely isolated with, which would be her captor.
Wow, thank you so much for sharing that. That is a very heavy topic. And with Domestic Violence Awareness Month coming up in October, I think it's really important for people to know about this, but I can understand for 3 years this would be a difficult thing to immerse yourself in. Is there anything from your research that you would be able to tell other people to expect from someone who might be experiencing a form of domestic or intimate partner violence?
Sure, yes, and this is a great question. In my research, what I essentially conclude is that an individual who has had certain abusive behaviors targeted toward her, the aim of these abusive behaviors is literally to undermine her personal identity and then to reshape it such that she no longer serves her own interests, but always is seeking to serve the needs of her captor. What this means is that it's not just a woman who has been broken down and she's tired, so she's doing what her partner wants her to do. It's literally that her identity has been reshaped such that she begins to view the world in terms of his needs and desires. This explains a lot of why women who are given the opportunity to leave do not leave initially. It takes them a very long time, and to the frustrations of friends and family, they oftentimes will go back even once they have successfully left, or unsuccessfully, as it were. Point being, if you care about the person who you believe is going through a situation of domestic violence, you should expect that they will have an extremely difficult time leaving. If you do get them to leave and they do go back and you actually care for this person, do not give up on them. The difficulty stems from the fact that their identity has actually been reshaped. And what that means is that they need to get into a rehabilitation program to help them return to themselves, to rebuild themselves. And one thing that I found in my research is absolutely crucial for an individual who is trying to rehabilitate herself is that she re-envision her own future with her at the center of it. Because the major obstacle here is that the individual is made to believe that she doesn't have a future, or at least she doesn't have a future without this man in her life or any abuser in her life to tell her what to do. So she needs to be given the space, but also the support to re-envision her future and believe in that future. And in order for her to do so, she will need people in her life who are willing to walk that long walk with her and hold her hand, even though I know from experience that it is very frustrating and can be very lengthy.
Thank you so much for saying that. I'm actually really glad that you pointed that out, because we know that, you know, studies show that it takes an average of 7 to 8 times before a victim leaves their abusive partner. And of course, you know, we're talking in gendered language right now, but anyone can be a victim of abuse, domestic violence, or intimate partner violence as well. I know you're speaking from your research and from personal experience, but I felt like that was important to name as well. So, okay. Do you mind if I ask if there is anything that you learned about yourself or discovered about yourself, past, present, or even future?
Sure, absolutely. Again, thank you for asking. As I noted before, this was a personal project, but initially I did not acknowledge that fact to myself. I think that after I had gotten away from the abusive situation that I found myself in, I tried to put it away and not think about it anymore. It was something that had happened in the past. But it's clear to me now, looking back, that I chose the topic. Something unconscious in me was trying to work itself out. And it did. Again, I started out the project at a very theoretical level, and I believe it happened that way because I was, in a sense, hiding from my own truth, my own history. It was easier to deal with the works of Aristotle than to deal with my own past. There came a point where I was trying to figure out how an individual can lose herself in states of anxiety. And I had a very surreal experience towards the end of my third chapter of my dissertation, where I was trying to work through this notion of anxiety. And I heard a voice, I heard an actual voice saying no. And then I realized that it was my own voice. I was sitting at the computer screen and I was saying no over and over again. And at that moment I thought to myself, what is happening right now? Like, why am I talking to myself at my computer screen? And I realized in that moment that I was actually hiding from myself and that I had to be very honest with myself if I was going to push through on this 3-year project that I'd been working on. And so I sat at my computer screen, hands on the keyboard, and I looked at what I had allowed to happen to myself. And I was able to look at it in such a way that I understood through the lens of philosophy how what had happened to me was not my fault and how I had been manipulated, and the manipulation that had occurred took place because this is how human consciousness is structured, and certain triggers allow for us to hide away from ourselves. It's easier to hide than to actually deal with the anxiety and the fear that comes with this mental and physical abuse. And I was actually even able to connect it much farther back to childhood traumas of abandonment and emotional neglect that required me to just become more self-aware, to understand how certain protective measures that I had taken as a child had at one point worked and then at another point had gone into my adult life and allowed me to get into dangerous situations rather than walk out the door like a healthy individual definitely would have.
Mm. Well, so I want to, in the same breath, I heard you say that, you know, the putting yourself in these situations, like you putting yourself in the situation and also saying that it was not your fault. And I definitely believe that it is not your fault, but I'm wondering where that sort of seemingly conflicting ideals are. Like, where is that for you?
Sure. Yeah, that's a great question, and probably not something I've even explored myself thus far, having just pushed forward with all of this. I think there are moments in my life where I have been with an individual understanding that the situation is not safe in my mind, but since I had become calloused to actually feeling emotional pain, that it didn't seem like a big deal at the time. Like, in my mind, I knew it was dangerous. But since I didn't feel afraid, I thought, well, this will pass and things will get better. And any individual who has gone through domestic violence or have studied domestic violence knows that it works in cycles, that there's some a time of madness, there's a time of outburst, and then things will get better, and then inevitably things will get worse again. And I think it was my inability to feel fear that I guess is why I'm saying I allowed myself to stay in those situations.
I see. Thank you so much for answering that. You know, it sounds like with these 3 years that, I mean, a PhD in and of itself is quite stressful, I would imagine. And so on top of writing a PhD on a pretty difficult topic to begin with, it feels like you were also sort of lifting the veil on your own past. And so I'm wondering what, if any, self-care you engaged in during those 3 years and continue to engage in, if at all.
Right. You're not the first person to ask me that. And my best answer to that question is I feel as if the dissertation project was a self-exploration, even if I never consciously intended for it to be. And my experience was that in reading other women's stories, no matter how horrific they were, I took from them that they survived and that they coped and they came out the other side to be able to tell their stories for the most part.
I see. So you found a little bit of solace in the solidarity of it all.
Absolutely.
Wow. Well, thank you so much for sharing all of that with us. Is there anything you wish that you'd known or been taught differently when you were younger that you would like to maybe share with our listeners?
I would like to encourage individuals to be attentive to the needs and emotions of children. I feel like a lot of my situations stem from not only an initial situation of abandonment, but also, you know, an inability to connect with others. And I think that in this time when there is so much divorce, so much separation, it's easy to think, oh, well, this, you know, this is so common that maybe separation isn't going to really adversely affect the child because it's such a common thing. But at least in my instance, I really did suffer for many, many years unknowingly to myself. It did cause me a big setback in my life, I would say. And so I would encourage people to take the needs and emotions of children very seriously. A lot of my work deals with how we come to be who we are through the cultivation of habitual activities that help us see the world. And so those are very formative years. And also for younger people to be mindful of your emotions. Don't put yourself second. Make sure that you're taking care of yourself first, because if you're healthy and you're capable of getting in touch with yourself, that's how you're going to be in touch with others and be the most caring individual that you can be for others as well.
Great. I think that's really, really great advice. And I actually really love that you highlighted children and paying attention to children, because it's so important to note that the socialization of girls and boys it happens so young. So I love that. I think that's a really, really great piece of advice. Thank you so much for being on our podcast and for talking with me today. Is there anything else, like any parting words or anything else that you just want to share or promote even?
Well, thank you very much for having me on here. I'm very excited to be invited here and also to be more in touch with your organization. I'd just like to say, since I am the Director of Communications and Visibility for American Association of University Women, Empire State, New York City branch, I am currently creating a series of interviews that will showcase our local AAUW talent here in New York City. We have a huge pool of really amazing women. We will be starting a new YouTube page here in the very near future, and I'm really looking forward to highlighting and spreading the word about the amazing scholars that we have in our organization here in New York City.
Thank you so much, Jessica, for sharing so much of your story with us. We are deeply, deeply honored. And listeners, I'll include some information about the AAUW Empire State Branch in our episode description.
If you've been listening to Sex Talk Happy Hour from the beginning, you know that our second episode focused on the experience of survivors of sexual violence. That episode is called Healing in Dinosaurs, by the way, in case you want a refresher. At the end of that episode, we brought in an expert to provide practical tips for those of you who might be trying to support a survivor of sexual violence. This worked out pretty well, so we thought we'd bring this model back to this episode. In the next bit, I got to speak with Lorena Giron, who is an Equal Justice Works Fellow who works at the organization called Day One. Thank you so much for being with us today, Lorena. We're so lucky to have you.
Oh, thank you.
So, in observance of Domestic Violence Awareness Month, I thought it would be a good idea for all of us to have a little bit of a refresher on understanding how to support someone who maybe might be experiencing an abusive relationship. So, since you're an expert on the topic, I'm excited to have you provide some of your expertise. We're really, really grateful for you and your organization. So, first, can you tell us a little bit about Day One and the work that you do there?
Sure. So Day One is a nonprofit in New York City, and we work with young people aged 24 and under who are survivors of intimate partner violence or dating abuse. Day One does a host of things. So we've got a legal department, of which I am a part of. We've got social services, and we've got our community education team, our educators, who also educate professionals. The education team does a lot of the preventative work. So they do not only education, but healthy relationship trainings and workshops. And they go out, we've got a middle school team, we've got a high school team. They go out into colleges or anywhere in the community that might be helpful. Our social services team does the really, really important kind of supportive therapy work that survivors who come to Day One might need. We also have a case manager who helps a lot of our clients with things like obtaining benefits or housing. And then the legal services does the orders of protection or going into court with clients to obtain orders of protection. We also do custody issues. If our clients have children, we help them navigate that. We also do criminal advocacy, which entails more kind of working with law enforcement or helping a client navigate that system or navigate even the criminal justice system or a criminal court, which a lot of the time can be really scary. So we do all of that. And in addition to that, when our clients have immigration issues or maybe might be undocumented or have kind of unstable immigration status, we help them with that as well. So we will file DV-based immigration petitions for our clients.
Gotcha. So you and Day One do a couple of things at your agency. That's amazing. We're so lucky to have you here with us today. And listeners, I will be including Day One's information in the episode description. So if you do want more information, please make sure you check their website out. Okay. So one thing I hear often when I'm talking to people who know someone who's in an abusive relationship is simply, why don't you just leave? And I'm wondering if you could give us some insight into why this might be a problematic thing to say.
Yeah, there are a host of reasons why that might be a problematic thing to say. The top one is that sometimes telling someone to just leave, not only does that trivialize their experience, but it might be giving them the option or telling them to take an option that might put them in more danger. Because we know that intimate partner violence and dating abuse are both about power and control over your partner, it's also important to know that when the abuser loses that power and control, they can become even more violent or more dangerous. And so we also know and have seen through studies that when a person leaves an abusive relationship, the abuser becomes more violent, and that's when fatality rates are actually at the highest. That's probably because the abuser has lost control or feels like they're losing control of the situation, and that's not where the abuser wants to be. They want to be in control. And so when they feel they've lost control or power over their partner, that's when they become the most violent with their partner. And so telling someone to leave or just leave an abusive relationship is basically telling them, okay, go put yourself in this even more dangerous situation. That can be the case a lot of the time. Secondly, a lot of the times a survivor cannot physically, financially leave the situation. And so even though intimate partner violence can happen among couples who don't live together or not in the same household, most of the time it does happen among those couples, right? And a survivor, many of the times, is completely dependent on his or her or their abuser. And so when you tell them just leave, you're basically telling them to, like, be homeless because they have nowhere else to go. They might have nowhere else to go. They might not have any family that can support them. They might not have the financial resources to move. In New York City, especially where we're based, getting an apartment means, you know, putting first, last, and, like, 3 months rent ahead of time. And a lot of people can't do that. So financially, it's completely impossible. Thirdly, a lot of the times survivors share a child or, you know, pets with their abuser. And so telling them to just leave is telling them to leave behind a lot of not only possessions, but it could be telling them to leave behind a child or a pet, which means, you know, if you're a survivor, you're thinking of the safety of your child or your pet. And if you can't take your child with you, if you tell someone to just leave, then you're telling them to leave behind and put even in danger someone or something that they care deeply about. Many times we've seen at day one, at least in the legal team, the court system is used as another tool of abuse. And so abusers, you know, when you have a child in common with someone, you're tied to them. And so abusers will use the child in common, or they'll seek custody of the child. They'll threaten custody. They'll say, you know, I'm going to get full custody of our child if you leave. And so it's really not an option for survivors. Unfortunately, a lot of our clients as well, because they have immigration issues, abusers will say, well, if you leave, or if you call the police, or if you do this or that, I'll have you deported. I can call ICE right away. I won't, you know, follow through with this immigration petition that I filed on your behalf. And unfortunately, people don't know that there are laws in place to prevent just that situation. Well, you know, but we do get survivors who come and say, well, I was told, he told me he wouldn't get me my, you know, the green card, that he would have me deported, that he would call ICE on me. And that's just another way that abusers maintain control over a situation, and where telling someone to just leave is really impossible for them.
Yeah, so it sounds like why don't you just leave is sort of vastly oversimplifying the situation. So instead of saying that, do you have any thoughts on what might be some supportive things that we could say to someone who might be experiencing abuse?
Yeah, you know, if you are someone who you have a friend who is experiencing abuse, it's really important not to trivialize or belittle that person's situation. And if you're able to, referring them to services like Day One's social and legal services is, I think, the first thing that should be done. If you are able to just be empathetic and sympathize with them, listen to them, acknowledge that they're going through something really difficult. I think a lot of the time survivors really just need someone who's there supporting them. The most important thing, I think, is not to blame victim blame, or not to blame a survivor for the situation that they're in. And like we said, telling them to leave is also something that I would advise against. And then if you're someone who are licensed in some way to help safety plan, that would be helpful. But I think referring a survivor to services where they can speak to professionals who can help them either safety plan or figure out what their next step is going to be, I think would be really helpful.
Gotcha. And actually, just because you mentioned it, I would love for you to maybe quickly define or share what you believe safety planning is, just so our listeners can have an idea of what that is.
Yeah, so safety plan, it's a little bit of a term of art. It is something that sometimes I think that people try to do, but again, I think it's really something for professionals to do with a survivor. And so it's basically when either, you know, in the legal team we do it, but it's mostly our social service providers who do this, will sit down with a survivor and kind of assess where the survivor is in terms of fear, maybe do like a fatality check if there are things like weapons present in the home and things like that, and then figure out how to either communicate with the provider, for the survivor to communicate with the provider if things go awry, if things escalate. For example, a provider might come up with alternate means of communication besides just a cell phone, because we know that abusers can sometimes have complete control over a survivor's cell phone. Maybe set up email addresses that an abuser has no access to. Perhaps a third party, and this is where friends might be the most helpful, is maybe the provider can set up a time to meet with the survivor through a third party who's a friend who the abuser knows and so is not suspicious of, for example. So it's mostly about assessing a situation and figuring out where the survivor is in terms of fear level, safety level, threat level, and then taking steps to figure out how to de-escalate a situation or to go towards a more stable place for the survivor to feel safer.
Gotcha. So I'm hearing a lot of support, 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 make sure that the survivor doesn't feel like they're alone, and also get professional help.
Yes, absolutely.
Gotcha. For our listeners, could you just really quickly define the difference between intimate partner violence and domestic violence? Are they sort of used interchangeably, or are there specific nuances there?
Yeah, they are a little bit used interchangeably, but intimate partner violence, I think, is a more modern term, because domestic violence was the term used for basically when a husband and wife, when it was only, you know, male, very heteronormative male-female marriage in the same house, right? And that's when domestic violence became a term, when you had two people who were married and lived together, and then there was abuse there. Intimate partner violence is an acknowledgement of the fact that now everything is different. Basically, courting rituals are different, you know, couples look different, act different, couples are getting married later and later, if at all. And so that means that people who are couples are not necessarily two people who live under the same roof or who are married. And so intimate partner violence is about acknowledging, or using a term that acknowledges the fact that two people might not live together, so are not domestic, you know, in terms of living in a house. And also that they might not be husband and wife, that they might just be a couple, who they might be a man and man, a woman and a woman, a transgender person, a gender fluid person. It could be really anyone, but it's just acknowledgement of the fact that this kind of abuse happens to couples who are not your typical heteronormative married couple that live in the same house. That this kind of abuse can happen to two people who go to college together, two people who go to high school together. And so it's a better term because it encompasses all of that.
Gotcha. And one thing that I hear a lot is people sort of thinking that all IPV and domestic violence, or intimate partner violence and domestic violence, are always physical. Are there different forms of abuse that can be used in these relationships?
Yes, absolutely. And I alluded a little bit to them before, but we're seeing a lot more technological abuse. So you've got your physical abuse is common, unfortunately, and it is still definitely the type of abuse people think of, but now with the advent of cell phones and technology, we've got a lot of technological abuse happening, which is basically, you know, monitoring someone's cell phone, figuring out where they are all the time, putting spyware on their cell phone and using that to basically stalk them and control their movements and know where they are at all times. Or we're seeing a lot of what mainstream calls revenge porn, where someone, you know, might share intimate images, and then one of the people in that couple might decide to use that image to coerce the other person to do things or not do things. And we're also seeing a lot of financial abuse, where one person in the couple might have complete control of the finances, and so uses that to control basically the other person, right? By not giving them money to do things, or threatening to take away money for doing something or not doing something. And there's also emotional abuse, of course, which is manipulation of the other person, using really foul language towards them, berating them, belittling them, putting them down all the time. And that's definitely a form of abuse that we see a lot as well. And then, you know, when one of the two people in the relationship is undocumented or has immigration concerns, unfortunately, we see a lot of that as a form of abuse, kind of using the person's immigration status to control them.
Gotcha. So what I'm hearing is that no matter what kind of behaviors it is, whether it's physically violent or emotionally violent, the theme that I'm highlighting here is that control is the root of it all.
Yes. Power and control, that's definitely the main cause of intimate partner violence.
Gotcha. Well, thank you so much, Lorena, for being here with us today. And I just wanted to ask one last question. If you have any thoughts or words of love or advice for those who might be currently or have previously experienced relationship violence.
Yeah, I would definitely just say that you should know that you're not alone, and that there, unfortunately, are many people who might be going through the same thing you are. that you have people who are willing and able and ready to support you, just like us here at Day One, that you are also powerful, and that if you feel like you need support, that you should just reach out and grab it, because we're here and ready.
Thank you so much, Lorena. We're so lucky to have had you with us today.
Thank you very much for having me.
Thank you, Lorena. We are really grateful for your expertise and words of advice. And like I mentioned earlier, we will be posting all of Day One's information and website on our episode description. Thank you again. Okay, now it's time for our new segment, Let's Talk Sex. This is our newest segment where I ask a question about sex and relationships to a random person and see what they have to say. This week, we have Stephanie.
Hi, can you introduce yourself?
Hi, I'm Stephanie. I'm 29 and I'm from New York.
Awesome. Stephanie, I'm so glad you're here. Thanks for doing Let's Talk Sex. So we're going to be asking you, how do you like to bring up something that you want to try that's new with a partner?
I am usually very direct, and usually I'll just straight up ask. One time I remember with a boyfriend, I actually read a trick in a women's magazine for, you know, one of those, like, pleasure your man columns or whatever, which I know are definitely not one size fits all. But I told the guy I was dating at the time, I said, hey, I read this in a magazine. Can I try it on you? And he was like, sure. So that in that instance, that technique worked very well. In other circumstances with other guys, I've just said, like, hey, like, I haven't framed it that way. I mostly frame it as in, like, hey, do you want to try this just to switch things up? And I've almost universally gotten a positive response from that. So, yeah, pretty much just straight up asking is my strategy.
Perfect. Thanks, Stephanie.
Thank you.
Thank you, Stephanie. Listeners, if you want to be featured on our Let's Talk Sex segment, you can email me at jyoon@svfreenyc.org. That email will also be on our episode description. Thank you for listening today, everyone. Hopefully, some of you will feel better equipped and prepared to support a loved one experiencing abuse after listening. I sincerely hope that no one has experienced this, but if you have, or if you are supporting someone who has, I hope that you will have learned something from today's episode. I know I did. If you do have any follow-up questions or thoughts, you can always reach us at the Alliance or reach out to other organizations like Day One. Thank you to the Alliance staff and to my supervisors who make this project possible. To Nikki Cruz, who runs our social media and is amazing as always. To the people who work at Day One for all of the incredible work that you do to help disrupt and prevent domestic and dating violence. Of course, a special thanks goes out to Lorena for providing her expertise on the subject. And again, if you want to learn more about Day One as an organization, you can check out their website, www.dayoneny.org. Again, the link will be in our episode description. Thank you to Jessica for taking time out of your very busy schedule to share something so personal with all of us. I am inspired by your strength and bravery and willingness to share a part of you, and I am honored to know you and to have had the opportunity to hear your story. And thank you to you, our listeners. If you found our episode interesting today, please subscribe and rate us on iTunes and leave us a review. Let us know if you have any topics you want to hear about or if you have any feedback or comments whatsoever. You can tweet at us at NYCAASA or message us on Instagram at NYC Alliance. And make sure you use our hashtag, #SexTalkHappyHour, all one word. Thanks so much for listening today, and take care of yourself and each other as we navigate this world. Ciao for now. We'll see you next time.